Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids Podcast, where we explore what connects us all in our yoga practice and in our lives. This is where I talk to people about their stories, who they are, what they've been through, and where they're going. And in this podcast, that's what we explore. I believe deep down inside, we're all connected, which explains why we bring ourselves to the top of our mat every day. Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids.
So welcome to the next edition of the Heartbreak Kids. I'm here with Eddie Stern, and to be honest with you, he needs no introduction from me. He's the author of One Simple Thing. He's an Ashtanga Yoga certified teacher, and he's definitely someone I look up to. So Eddie, I really appreciate you being on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Taylor Hunt.
Yeah, so the first thing I want to do is just grab a little background information. And I think what's the most important is just to kind of give our listeners a taste of like who Eddie is. And so how did you come to Ashtanga Yoga?
Well, I don't know about the who Eddie is part, if I may, since you asked, my wife and I and my daughter, we just moved back into Manhattan from Brooklyn, where we were for about 4 years. And now we're living in Greenwich Village again. And this is where I grew up. Our apartment is just a few blocks away from where I spent, most of my entire life already. And we live right next to a park called Washington Square Park. And it was in Washington Square Park in around 1986 or so that early one morning at about 5 a.m. or 6 a.m., after I had been up all night tripping on acid with my head, and I was playing my guitar, that a guy came up to me and we started talking. And somehow I guess I got on to some of the things I had been thinking about during that particular trip. And he started telling me about Ram Dass and asking me if I knew who Ram Dass was, because the stuff I was talking about were the type of things that Ram Dass was talking about. And I said, I'd never heard of Ram Dass before. In fact, I didn't even know what those words meant. I didn't even know it was a name. I had never heard really anything like a spiritual name or stuff like that. Ted had been giving me books on yoga to read, and I had become a vegetarian already. But the yoga books that he was giving me were from Rajneesh. This was before he was called Osho. And books on yoga sutras and stuff like that.
Why do you think you were compelled, or why do you think you were kind of drawn to that, during that period of your time, of your life?
Well, I think that the reason I was drawn to it was because I was on a spiritual quest, or at least I was on a quest to know who I was and know what the meaning of life was, like not even the meaning of life on a larger picture, but what the meaning of my own life was. And this was something that had driven me from the time I was in my early teens. I was really curious about, like, school had no meaning for me whatsoever, and I couldn't wait for it to be done because I wanted to be free. And I questioned a lot, like, what did any of this mean? And I think that's some of the stuff that drove me into the punk rock movement and things like that. But the reason I bring up Washington Square Park is that now that we're living back here, I went over to the park early this morning, and I started remembering, like, my first days of yoga really vividly. The apartment that I lived on in Thompson Street that Ted and I shared, it was like a 400 square foot studio for $650 a month.
Wow.
I used to, that's where I started meditating and chanting, like the Kundalini yoga stuff that I was learning. And I remember really vividly, like, sitting on the roof of that building on Thompson Street, looking out over the park and just chanting, like, until I would go into an oblivion. And all these memories of, like, what it felt like to be doing yoga. And by yoga, I mean chanting and meditation.
Sure.
Not any asanas. Those visceral feelings started coming back to me, and it's really nice to be back in this area. And now that I don't have a yoga school anymore, and I jokingly say that I'm retired, I kind of feel like, I'm 18 or 19 again, and rediscovering all of these things that I've actually been doing, like, the majority of my adult life. I went to India when I was 20, now I'm 51. This is all I've been doing for the 31 years, but now it feels really fresh again. So, when you ask about, like, to give you an idea of who I am or what it is that I do, actually this feeling that I had of being really interested and really curious about meditating, about chanting, about doing yoga, and, like, what the experience is of being, that's still really, like, that's that's pretty much it. That's what I'm interested in. And it's so nice to be back in this area again and connect with the like, as I said, this visceral feeling of how you feel or how you felt the first times you did yoga, that like a whole new world opened up to you, you know, and everything started to shift. That's an experience everybody has when they do yoga for the first times. And it's nice to really be in the area where that first happened. And so I was thinking of, you know, I want to do a little bit of a walking tour of my early yoga life and take some photos of all the different places in the village where yoga or spirituality was available, and kind of like, I don't know, a little a photographic walking tour, maybe write a blog post about it or something, where Dharma Mitra's first school was, and
right,
the Jiva Mukti Yoga Society was before it was a yoga brand, and you know, where the first Kundalini Yoga school was above Esoterica. And Esoterica originally was a bookstore that was run by, it was actually an antique store by a guy named Rudy, whose name was Rudrananda. And if you've never read anything by Rudy, you could check him out. He was one of the very important sort of first Jewish mystics of New York in the 1970s. They decided of Swami Muktananda, but had a really deep connection with Swami Nityananda, who was Muktananda's guru. So all this kind of interesting stuff. And it's, you know, just these past few days, it's all sort of flooding back in. It's kind of, I like it.
It sounds like you're kind of in a similar place of what I am, where you're kind of like sort of going back to your roots. You know, because I've been doing a lot of work. You know, I've been traveling a lot as well and doing these things, but it seems like, you know, you get further away from like the things that you really are seeking because you're giving it away to other people. Uh-huh. And I feel like recently I've been coming back to like, you know, the real spiritual part of the practice and why I did it in the first place. I mean, that connection with God was the most important thing to me. That's the reason why I practiced. Mm-hmm. And somewhere along the way, it seems like that's still there, but it becomes about other things. And so it sounds like we're kind of in similar spots.
The connection you were looking for to God, was this something that did you have a religious upbringing, or this was just something, or was this from like 12-step programs, or was this early in you? Where did that come from?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. You know, honestly, from a very young age, I felt very devout. And I was raised as a Christian. My mother is a German Jew. My dad is like a Christian. They were Catholic before they kind of converted. But I mean, I went to Sunday school. I did those things. Like, but somewhere along my path, I kind of like lost focus of God. Getting sober, I kind of came back to that understanding. And I always felt like I had that connection, but I felt like I walked away from it at a certain point. And so my yoga practice, like, was you know, like the first couple times that I did it, it felt like a breath of fresh air because I felt this connection with myself. My body, my mind felt more at ease. And then I felt like I was able to listen enough, get out of my head enough to like listen so that if ever I was going to be spoken to or hear some sort of message, I was available to it instead of all the racket that was in my head. Hmm. And so that's really what drove me to do it.
What kind of when you say like a yearning for God, mm-hmm, what does that mean to you? Like, how do you conceive of what God might be for you?
Wow, that's a really deep question. You know, for me, I think that how I have a yearning to be in alignment with God is through heart and through connection with other people. How I interact with them and how I keep my side of the street clean and how I go to a place of like service and helping people and being connected with them. Because I know isolation. I mean, that is what addiction is. And, you know, I was completely isolated and coming back to this place where I could reconnect with people, because for the longest time I was basically in solitary confinement. You know, I'm not sure if you read my book or not. I don't expect you to, but you know, I basically for 10 years, I was, you know, stuck in addiction, put needles in my arms every single day and by myself and also sometimes with people that, you know, are unsavory characters for sure. And so like getting out of that and like kind of putting myself back into society and having that help and support and giving service and all of this stuff is like my way of reconnecting with God and doing what I feel like is God's work, you know, like getting out of my own way so that I can be of service to another human being.
Beautiful. So you really see it in connection.
Of course. 100%.
Yeah. It's interesting. We meaning my wife and I were in India in February and we had the opportunity to go spend an hour with the Dalai Lama with a group of other people. And he was talking about how, you know, the ways that feelings of self-importance can arise in you and that all over the place. People think that he is the Dalai Lama, and they treat him like he is the Dalai Lama. And he said if he starts believing them and starts thinking that he's the Dalai Lama and that he's special because he's the Dalai Lama, then in that feeling of self-importance, what I thought he was going to say was that he begins to feel, you know, a sense of I-ness or ego or some kind of thing like that. But instead he said, if I allow myself to feel that I'm self-important, then I become lonely. And I thought, wow, that's really super perceptive.
That is really perceptive.
When you think that you're more important than other people, you isolate yourself from them.
Yeah.
In isolation, you become lonely. And this is definitely the curse of celebrity in the world. You know, celebrities, everyone thinks, oh my God, they have everything. Actually, they're like some of the most lonely people because everyone thinks that they're special, where really what they'd like to do is connect, and everyone around them just wants stuff from them. So I thought that was really a powerful statement.
That just gave me chills. So thank you for saying that.
Yeah, I become lonely. And to hear the Dalai Lama say that was like even for some reason more powerful.
Yeah. It's weird though too, because like in the yoga community, I feel like people, you know, put teachers up on pedestals and, you know, and this happens in every community or everything. It's like celebrity and all that stuff also experience it. But like, how do you manage that? Like because I'm 100% certain that people put you up on pedestals. Like, how do you not get lonely?
Well, first of all, I don't understand why anyone would want to put me on a pedestal. Like, I don't belong on one in the first place, and I don't understand why anyone would want to put me there, if they do at all. So if people treat me like that, I just don't get it. So therefore, you know, like everybody else, I like to be loved. I like to be appreciated. I like to be told by people that, you know, oh, I liked your book, or, you know, I like this thing you did.
Of course.
It's nice to have your work appreciated. You know, as far as like the rest of it, I don't, you know, I really don't know. Like, I just don't let it in because it's ridiculous. Yeah. I'm like a person who struggles to do my practice like everybody else. It requires effort. Even though I love this stuff, it requires effort to do it. I feel like I know so little, close to nothing. So I continue to always study because I'm interested in it. And, I think of myself as much of a person who is learning. I still think of myself as a student because, you know, people say that all the time. Maybe they don't mean it, but I love learning. You know, I like to study stuff and pick new things up to add to my understanding of just stuff, you know, what's going on in the world and how are we made and how do things operate. And I like all that stuff. So I do all this because I like it. I enjoy it. I love it. I like teaching yoga. I like practicing yoga. That's all there is to it. I'm not a senior teacher. I'm not a, you know, leader in the yoga community. I'm not a representative of Patabi Joyce and the Ashtanga yoga lineage. In my mind, I'm not any of those things. In my mind, I'm someone who loves yoga and who also really likes people. And one of the reasons that I teach and that I do the things that I do, whether it's nonprofit work or anything else, is because I like people. I like talking to people and learning from people and all that. I'm not a terribly social person. Like, I don't go out to parties and I don't particularly like parties because they're too loud and you have to talk a lot and then your throat hurts.
I don't like them either.
I spend a lot of time just with my wife and my daughter when she's home from college, and we spend a lot of time at home, but I like people and I like connecting with people and learning from them. So this whole, like, you know, yoga rock star thing is, I don't think it's helpful for the community, quote unquote community or the world. And I also think that and I've spoken about this a lot too, that the guru tradition is an Indian cultural tradition. I don't know how well it works over here. In fact, I don't think it works well at all. And even these days in India, I'm not too sure how well it works. And a lot of Indians agree with me on that. Last week, my friends from the Hindu American Foundation were over here, Suhag and Sheetal, and we were having a long discussion about power dynamics and the guru tradition and what the roots of the guru tradition were and how maybe that tradition isn't working so well anymore, especially with the mega gurus and the people who give up all sense of agency to those mega gurus, even though they might not have any personal connection with them. And some of the positive and negative things about that. So,
well, what is the biggest downfall, or why do you think it doesn't work in the West?
The reason I don't think it works in the West is because it's not part of our cultural tradition. We have a different kind of relationship with teachers and with mentors than has been in India for literally thousands and thousands of years. So whatever the new academics want to say about modern yoga or the inconsistencies in yoga traditions or whatever, I don't really care all about what they have to say about that. I mean, actually, I do care because I have a lot of opinions about it. But one thing for sure that is uncontestable is that yoga has survived because of the guru-shishya relationship. That is how yoga has been passed down.
Correct.
From the time of the Upanishads till the time of now, that is how yoga has been passed down in India. In America, I can't speak for Europe because I'm not a European, but in America, when we start becoming teachers, I don't think it's reasonable for us to expect that we can begin to play that role of an Indian cultural institution within the framework of our upbringing, our education, and everything. There are the rare people, I think, who might be able to do it if they were raised in, say, Gurukul, but even then, it's a little bit dangerous. I know very, very few people who have been able to pull it off successfully, and I don't mean pull it off in any derogatory sense.
Like
Radhanath Swami is one example of a Westerner who has been able to embrace and embody the role of a traditional Hindu guru, and has done very, very good things. And he primarily lived in India anyway. So I think it was, and he must have had a deep samskara for it. So it's very natural to him. I mean, I'm sure he struggles in his own particular ways, but what he's done in India is nothing short of phenomenal. And his devotee base in America are a very, very dedicated and very kind group of people. So he's definitely doing something right.
Wow.
A lot of the others who you see, especially who don't have any kind of devotional background to rest their teachings on, and they're mainly focused on the yoga teachings, then we see them have a lot of problems.
Yeah.
Whether it's ego problems or greed problems or whatever, you name it. We see a lot of that over here. And now you see it in India as well.
Yeah.
So my feeling about what we should do in America is that instead of having the guru tradition over here, we can just have like elder spiritual friends. And I can be like, you know, a spiritual friend to somebody else, or just, you know, an instructor in techniques. And then you make of those techniques what you will. And I can just give you a little bit of guidance based on what I've learned so far myself.
Yeah.
So
like someone further along the path instead of like someone who is put up on a pedestal, like we were speaking about.
You know, and someone who's a little bit further along the path, but only for maybe one or two particular things. And that's the problem that I see occurring is that, you know, people get good at asanas and maybe some pranayamas, or maybe they go on a few meditation retreats, and then they start thinking that they're an important teacher, and then they gather a lot of students. And then they start thinking that because they know a little bit about one thing, that they're fit to talk about anything with authority. But maybe the only thing they know is just how to do asanas.
Yeah.
And they're not fit to give guidance on other things. So I think that's very important to keep that perspective for those of us who might consider ourselves to be yoga teachers, that we, and this is the thing about the word guru. A guru is a teacher who has become very, very proficient in one particular thing, but not necessarily in everything. So you can be a guru of yoga, or you could be a guru of dance or art or Ayurveda or grammar or philosophy, but that doesn't mean that just because you're good at one thing that you can speak about anything else with great authority. And this is one of the mistakes that people seem to make. So
what do you think the intersection is between like guru and like, you know, someone like myself who is like a teacher that goes around and teaches, like what's the intersection? I mean, I'm never trying to be a guru, but like, you know, I feel like a lot of times people, you know, in similar respects, like, you know, get to a place where all of a sudden they sort of kind of go into that role to a certain extent. I mean, what is the intersection? I mean, you know, because I teach asana, I teach about my experience with addiction and philosophy and, you know, the teachers that I've had over the years and able to share that information. But like, where's the slippery slope and where's that intersection?
I think the slippery slope is when you begin believing your own press. that's where I think it is. An intersection for, and these are all my own opinions. I could be completely wrong about everything. Quite often I am. So for me, flat out, guru tradition doesn't belong in America. This is an Indian cultural thing. I think it should be left in India. I think that if you happen to have a guru, then who's Indian or Western, that's fine. Like, you know, have that relationship. And I don't think we should try to become something that we're not. And that's, you know, that's all there. That's my feeling on it. And so, you know, for you or for me, we go around and we teach yoga and we talk about philosophy. And all you and I have to offer and all any teacher has to offer is the sum total of our experience. We can't give anything to anybody that we haven't learned or experienced so far. That's basic rule number one of teaching. So what we offer to people as teachers, and this is what every teacher offers to their students, no matter what the topic, is the sum total of their experience of the topic and hopefully their love for the material. So when I go around teaching, all I do is I talk about things that I'm really interested in or that I'm thinking about currently. And I'm pretty clear with people on this because a lot of the things I talk about are not necessarily things that I've studied in depth in a university setting, like neuroscience or epigenetics or anything like that. But I read about these things, I talk to doctors, I think about them, and I really love the material. So I share it with people. So that's kind of how I view my interaction with people, is one of sharing knowledge of things that I've read about, heard about, studied with, you know, different teachers. But mainly, they're things that I love and that I'm really interested in. And so I share those things. And because I'm sharing them with people, and I've already said that I like people and I like talking with people, then it becomes a little bit of an interaction. And that's kind of how I see teaching, as an interaction between one person who has a love of the material and then some other people who have an interest in learning about that material. But that the only thing that I really know are these small little things about the stuff I like, and that there are going to be a lot of people who are in those classes who might even know more about those topics than I do. And or who know a lot more about a lot of other stuff that I don't know anything about. So, you know, that's always a good thing to keep in mind too. Like,
yeah, well, sounds like you have a very good, you know, perspective on this. I mean, and I share the same one where it's just like I'm sharing the love and, you know, the stuff that I care about. And, you know, I get to talk a lot about addiction, and that's like a hot topic for me. And I get to share my experience on how, like, you know, obviously yoga can change someone's outcome. And I'm really passionate about that too, because I've seen it work countless times over and over and over, not just me, but for many people. And you write about that in your book as well.
I write about
I mean, you write about like how, you know, whatever you show up, and I don't actually have the book in front of me, but however you show up, whether it's like through fitness or through spiritual, or like the outcome is always like better. You get what you need out of the practice.
Yeah, I think so. And then sometimes quite a bit more that you didn't even expect.
Why? That is 100% true too. And so let's talk a little bit about the book. And so I was really fascinated by it, and I really appreciate you being on our book club. So my community had a book club, and you know, you were on it, and I really appreciate you kind of coming on and sharing your stuff. That was really powerful for our entire community. But what drew you to write the book? Was it just like you're fascinated with these topics like you were just mentioning, or was there some other compulsion to do it?
Well, there are a couple things. Number one is, yes, I was fascinated by the topics. I'd been lecturing on them for about 3 or 4 years, and basically the format of the book of what it is now. And also, I wasn't completely convinced that I could write a book. I've said this before, I'd collaborated on a bunch of different books, including Yogamala and all sorts of other stuff. But I didn't know if I could write one on my own. And because I didn't believe that I could, I sort of was driven to the challenge of trying to complete it. So to have completed it and published it, and then, you know, when I finally held it in my hands, I was pretty gratified because, all right, that was
done. That's a huge accomplishment. And
I know you've written a book, and so it's not an easy thing to actually, you know, to get one of those done.
It's not easy at all.
So, especially because, well, anyway, so I did it, and now I'm starting on the next one. And I see that, you know, I'm hoping that there might be a way that I could be useful in talking about yoga in the types of ways that I have been, which are the intersection of yoga and scientific thought. Now, yoga is a scientific thought system. It's always been considered in that way in India. One of the words for vidya, the yoga vidya, is the knowledge or the science of yoga. And science usually is you have a hypothesis, you structure an experiment or a study, you see your results, and then hopefully other people try to replicate those results to get the same or similar outcome. And so with yoga, the experiment is one in consciousness, and the techniques applied to that experiment are the different yoga practices, whether it's asanas, pranayama, meditation, chanting, devotion, service, or a combination of those. And then hopefully the outcome is going to be either liberation, self-realization, any of those types of words. And if that experiment is repeated enough and people keep on attaining quote-unquote liberation or enlightenment because of those different modalities, then you can be pretty certain that they're dependable. And that if you do them, you're going to get the kind of outcome that you're looking for. And you don't know in the beginning what the outcome of liberation or enlightenment might be, but apparently when you get there, you know. So that seems to be the common conversation or dialogue on that. So in that way, yoga is considered a science because there are very particular things you do to achieve a very particular result.
And so why don't you share with us the things that, and I believe you mentioned these in the book, but I mean, what are the things that you should be doing as a yoga practitioner or a yoga student to go down that path? Because I feel like a lot of people get sucked into this asana, vacuum. And they think that that is like, you know, that that means is the end actually of binding their hands in Marichasana D. But what are the things that we can do as a whole yoga community that sends us down that path to more consciousness? Maybe not enlightenment, just more consciousness.
Well, I can't speak for the whole yoga community, but I'll just speak about, you know, you and me and maybe a couple other people. So it's dangerous to speak for other people, right? And to tell other people what you think they should be doing. That's a great way to get yourself in trouble. So the vacuum of asanas is a fine vacuum to get sucked into as long as you remember that what you're trying to do in the asanas are expand your awareness to the entire potential of your physicality. And that if you use your body to expand your awareness, then you automatically enter into a state that is not ambitious, which is not grasping, which is not trying to use a posture to create a new sense of I for yourself, but that the posture is used in such a way that you experience being. And in that experience of being, you are not reaching for something other than what you are. So the question becomes, well, if that's the case, why do I need to keep on doing one asana after the other? And the reason for that is, well, number one, you don't. When you feel that you have done enough, you can stop. And number two, if you feel like you want to keep on going or your teacher encourages you to, you'll find that each time you do something which is a little bit challenging in a different way, your awareness can begin to expand or move inward in a different way as well. At a certain point, you will exhaust all of the different ways that you feel you need to move because you will just be established in awareness and there won't be a need to challenge that awareness in those same type of ways, but that you can continue to use the asanas that you have learned to keep yourself reminded of where it is that you want to be, which is in the present moment. So in that way, asanas are really, really helpful. They're a great tool because, after all, we live in our bodies. And if we forget that we live in our bodies, then we start to live either in our minds, which are not always all that trustworthy, or in our emotions that are coming and going all the time and can be quite turbulent, or in our reactive tendencies. So it's actually a lot kind of safer and more grounded to live in your body rather than not be connected to your body and live only in a world of changing thoughts, ideas, perceptions, reactivity, and changing emotions. So in this way, asanas are really,
that's a great point. Are there other things that you do besides asana that, you know, that you've having like a bunch of benefit from or you've gotten a bunch of benefit from?
Was that a reasonable answer? Or when I say that, do you just think to yourself, that's ridiculous? What is he even talking about?
If what?
what I just said about
us. No, I think that's a totally reasonable answer. I mean, I just think that it's such like a trap that, you know, like we're all after like the next pose or like to do this better, but like to be in the present moment, I mean, that is where all of the beauty is. I'm totally in the line. I totally agree with 100% of what you just said. But it's a matter of perspective. And also like, you know, you're 30 years into your journey, Eddie. And like, I'm sure there was times where all of a sudden, like you fell off of the path and, you know, to a certain extent, I feel like I fall off the path and then I'm able to gain awareness around it. And then back on the path of like not getting stuck in that asana trap, like currently, like what I was talking about with like, you know, that connection with other people and God and what that brings to me. And that is happening in the present moment while I'm practicing. So no, that's not an unreasonable answer at all.
Beautiful. One of the things about challenging yourself physically is that it can encourage you to be fully in the present. And that's, I mean, in any contemplative tradition, including ones that use the body in a movement-oriented way, like, you know, if you look at the different types of Zen meditation techniques or Taoist meditation techniques where you might be sitting for hours and hours a day, that's also using your body. And you sit in a position to the point where it becomes very, very uncomfortable, where you feel like your brain and body are going to explode. And if you can sit past that, you go into a state of expanded or elevated consciousness where that thing that which is being experienced in the field of your mind, the feeling of being about to explode, becomes not you, but a thought. And that
right.
You're not that thought, but that thought is happening through part of your biology, which is your brain and your body, but that you might be more than that. And so to challenge yourself physically is a very key component of, for lack of a better word, transcendence. And that means not to go out and away from, but to encapsulate the entire thing as not being you, but being everything. And so you as an individual. And so challenging yourself physically has always been a part of that. You need to do some type of quote-unquote penance. And that you see that in Christian tradition, in the Jewish tradition, in Islam, in Hinduism, in Taoism, in Zen practices, you name it, in Indian Native American sweat lodges, to sit in a sweat lodge for long periods of time, that is a tapas, literally.
Of course, yeah. You're boiling yourself.
So the use of the body is very important. So your point is good. Like, how do you then use your body in such a way that you use it for spiritual evolution or realization, expanded awareness, and you don't just use it for the sake of the glorification of this thing, which is bound to decay and eventually is not going to look very attractive anyway, and smell, and then you're going to die. So you're not trying to glorify this sheath of change. You're trying to glorify your inner being and let it shine through the sheath of change.
That's beautiful too. How do you think specifically the Ashtanga Yoga method helps people like to achieve that?
When you say Ashtanga Yoga method, do you mean like what Patabi Joyce taught?
I mean, yeah, let's start there because we could talk about both actually. But why do you think Ashtanga Yoga method taught by Patabi Joyce, you know, helps people achieve that?
All right. Well, you know, first of all, I don't think it's a method. I think that it's a practice. And I think a practice is different from a method because when you look at the Indian or the Hindu tradition, the idea of philosophy is very often something called praxis, a word you're probably familiar with, which means a lived philosophy. So that you take some particular principles and you try to carry them forth out into the way that you live your life. And that is ideally what any of the Hindu traditions strive to do, that we have certain things that we do, whether it's ritual or asanas or meditation or service, that begin to shift our perspective on ourselves and our connection or interconnection with the world that we are part of. That's definitely what yoga is, any of the forms. A method is usually like, a way of accomplishing some particular kind of an outcome. And in yoga, we're not supposed to be concerned with outcomes. We're supposed to be concerned with how we do something in that moment. That's the difference between a praxis and a method. A method always leads you towards a particular outcome. I want to get a super fit body. I want to conquer the world. I want to make money. I want to get good at this one particular thing. So that's just a little bit of like, and another reason why I don't use the word method is because then it gives this idea that this Ashtanga yoga thing is like a style of yoga or a brand of yoga. And I think that's also a little bit dangerous because then you start thinking that the style or brand that you do is like either the best one or a true one or a real one, or different than what other people are doing. And therefore, because it's different than what other people doing, it must be better because you're doing it and you're not doing something else.
And it comes all, us against them kind of thing.
All these subtle things creep in, and you can see that I was very much a part of that kind of thinking myself. I know where it comes from. So yoga it comes from a wanting to know things and to be right and to feel that what you're doing is the best possible thing to be doing. And because you're doing it, because you want to be right and to know. So really where it comes from is from not knowing what it is that you're doing and not knowing what it is. And that's why you end up thinking that. So anyway, just to continue to not answer your question,
right.
If we think, and this is where my mind is right now, like if we think that people are basically striving for the same kind of things, people are striving for, most people would like to be healthy. Most people would like to experience happiness. Most people would like to feel that there's meaning in their lives and that they are living in accordance with that meaning. For those who feel the desire to be connected to that meaning or connected to other people or to feel a part of something like the world that we live in or that we live with, then if these are some basic commonalities of people who come to yoga or come to meditation, like find all the commonalities and then live from that place. And then it doesn't really matter what the form is, whether it's Iyengar yoga, Bikram yoga, Kundalini yoga, Ashtanga yoga, Shivananda yoga. They're all just brand names at this point. Mm-hmm. Earlier, they weren't brand names. They were approaches to self-knowledge, but they weren't brands.
So you think we've fallen off of that path? Is that what you're suggesting?
Very much so, because this is why the yoga industry is a worldwide $4 trillion a year industry. Because things have been marketed, things have been sold. Now, you and I are part of that. And everyone who's listening to this, if anybody listens to this, is a part of that. We are part of this yoga consumeristic society right now. I love making a living teaching yoga, knock wood, may it continue. It's a great way to make a living. I'm very happy doing this.
I am too.
We use branding of things in order to set ourselves apart from other things in the marketplace so that we can, make some money and survive. So what does that lead us back to? It leads us back to survival issues. People, we all want to survive. Nobody wants to have no money, have no home, be out on the street, not be able to take care of our families. Like there's a lot of fear behind that. And it wasn't until very recently that people could actually make a living being yoga teachers. In the 1980s, when we were teaching at Shivananda and places like that, even when Jiva Mukti first opened, none of the yoga teachers were paid. We taught yoga as seva. That was the understanding.
Wow.
People would come to the yoga schools and they would pay for classes because the schools had to pay the rent and the buildings needed to exist. But the teachers who taught there were not paid. It was all seva.
Wow.
And that started to switch a little bit, at least in New York, around, you know, in the early 1990s. And the first time I actually accepted money for teaching yoga, I felt like so dirty. I felt like I had sold out completely. At that point, I felt like there was no redemption for me.
Wow.
I was so beholden to this idea that teaching yoga was service and that's it. That's why you did it.
Right. I mean, it seems like, I mean, you know, although I do get paid doing it, it still feels like service to me. Do you feel that now too, or am I off base?
No, I don't think you're off base at all. I don't think necessarily that what I'm doing is service. What I think I'm doing is educating, I guess.
Okay.
That's what teaching is. That's how what I see that I'm doing. I see that, you know, I know a particular thing, like how to help people in yoga, and people come to me and I try to help them with that. And that's basically what I do. And then if there's some other stuff I learn, which might help them have a more broad-based understanding of the practices, the physical practices that they're doing, then I'll teach those as well. Those are what the lectures are. And that's kind of a sharing. So that's sort of what I see I do. I guess I'm an educator of some sorts. And in other ways, I'm a sharer of information. And I guess what I can offer to people is just some perspective based on the experience I've had. But everyone is going to have their own experience and develop their own perspective at a certain point.
Right.
And you know, I don't feel any conflict anymore about getting paid for that, because I definitely do need to feed my family and myself on occasion. And I would rather be doing this than working at Chipotle.
Yeah.
But even if I had to work there, I'm sure I'd have a pretty good time.
What did you, I'm just curious, and this kind of just throws us back a little bit, but I'm curious, what were you doing for a living, you know, when you were just like basically giving yoga away as a service? What were you an artist, or what were you doing at that particular time?
Well, this goes from like 1988 until, I started teaching in 1989 actually.
Okay.
So 1989 until 1993. I did a few things. I used to print t-shirts, and that's what I did before I first went to India. I had a t-shirt company, and I sold my half of the business to my partner, and that gave me enough money to spend a bunch of time in India over the next 2 years. And when I came back, I continued to print t-shirts. I used to print the t-shirts for the Shivananda organization. And I printed and sold t-shirts at Jiva Mukti and some other yoga schools as well. Before that, I was doing rock and roll t-shirts.
Okay.
I used to work in my friend's, my friend had a tarot card shop selling all sorts of new age stuff. And I used to work part-time there. And then from like 1990 or 91, for like 1990, 1991, during those years, I was the assistant director of Jiva Mukti. And for that, I was paid a salary of $125 a week.
Wow.
And I taught classes every day at the school for free. And I lived at my mom's house. And that's how I was able to survive.
Wow.
And then up until the time when I started teaching on my own, I mainly was spending time in Mysore. And that was off of money that had saved. And also my grandfather had passed away and he left me $10,000. And so that money I basically lived off of from 1991 until 1993 when I started teaching.
Wow.
94. Then I went to India with my wife for a little over a year. We were in Mysore for about 15 months. And after that, came back. That's when we opened our school. Before then, I was just renting out places.
Yeah.
But in 1995, we opened our school.
And were you teaching Mysore style too? Or was it like, you know, were you teaching lead classes? Or what was happening during that teaching?
I only taught Mysore style.
Okay.
You know, from 1991 until 93, when I was in India a lot in Mysore, that was the only thing I'd ever seen. That's all I knew Ashtanga yoga was. And then in 93, Guruji came to New York, Boulder, and California. And that was the first time I ever saw a lead class.
Yeah.
And you know, we co-hosted him in New York. And then we went to California for 2 months to do the month of classes in LA, and then the month of classes with Tim in Encinitas when Guruji right. went down there. But when I came home, I continued to only teach Mysore because that's all I, you know, knew how to teach. I didn't know how to count anything yet. We didn't really start learning the countings until John Scott and Lino Miele did that book.
Right.
Primary and intermediate series. But before then, nobody had really bothered to learn the countings. If anyone was teaching lead classes, they were doing it by just saying inhale and exhale and the names of the poses. But no one knew Yekum Kwe from Chetwari.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. So maybe one final question and maybe a little bit more personal. But why is it that you show up on your mat every single day? Like, what? Why do you continue to do this 30 years after? And like, what is the experience that you're continually having on your mat? Because I, you know, as a fellow practitioner and a fellow student, it's like, you know, it's continue to evolve for me. But I think everyone wants to know, like, what happens after 30 years? Like, what is that commitment, or has it changed?
No, it's a totally fair question. I would like to practice for as long as humanly possible. I think it's really important to keep your body healthy and to keep your body in good shape. This is one of the first things that was Guruji wrote in Yogamala. In regards to the body, he said there is a maxim from the Dharma Shastras, Sharira Madhyam Kalu Dharma Sadhanam. And this means that your body is your first dharma. Your first dharma, your first duty is to take care of your body. Why? Because it's the home that you live in. And we should try to keep it clean and functioning and well-oiled so that it lasts us for a really long time.
Yeah.
Because the worst thing is to get old and not be able to take care of yourself and to become a burden to other people. So therefore, try to keep yourself healthy so you can live independently for as long as possible. And then when you die, to die, hopefully, a healthy death.
But is that one of the reasons why you practice, just to stay healthy in your body?
Primarily.
Okay.
Primarily. Because when it comes to a deep sense of interconnection, for me, that's meditation. When it comes to expression of devotion, that for me is ritual and puja and mantra. And so for the body, it is really, I do asanas to keep myself healthy and to keep myself being an embodied person. You know, there is a lot of wisdom of the body. There are a lot of things that we learn when we listen to our bodies. So to do asanas is also to practice the art of listening and the art of feeling the intercommunication of the entire cellular mechanism that we are being expressed through. So in the Vedantic tradition, they say that consciousness is pure being and it seeks to know itself through different modalities. And one of the ways that consciousness experiences itself is through bliss. And bliss experiences itself through the intellect. and the intellect experiences itself through the mind, and the mind experiences itself through the body. Well, through prana, and then prana experiences itself through the body. So the body is an experience in consciousness. The breath is an experience in consciousness. The mind is an experience in consciousness. The intellect is an experience in consciousness. Bliss is an experience in consciousness. And consciousness is an experience in consciousness. And so if you can feel the experience of your body, not the idea that you have one, but the experience of being expressed through your body, the experience of being expressed through the body, then it automatically turns your awareness inward towards deeper levels of being. So this is a very interesting use of the body to experience deeper levels of consciousness. And it is definitely something that I think about that's present in me while I do asanas. But it's also very, very fair for me to say that I'd also like to keep my body healthy for as long as possible.
Yeah.
So you have a relative use of asana, and that for me is the health and function and integration of my body with deeper levels of consciousness. And then there's more of an absolute or grand scale use of the body, which is to experience the body as an intermittent experience of consciousness.
Wow. That's beautiful. You've taught me a lot, and I'm sure you're going to teach the listeners a lot. And so maybe that's a good place to stop. I'd love to have you on the show again. I mean, we could literally probably do this for the next like 3 hours. But I would invite everyone to, obviously go to one of your workshops, and, you're going to be in San Diego soon. And you're also going to Matthew Darling's place, which is in Detroit. You'll be there in July. San Diego in July. And then also, Ashtanga Yoga, Michigan, and in Detroit in July 19th through the 21st. So I'd invite everyone out to your workshop to learn some more. I'd love to have you back on the show. I appreciate all of your thoughts, and you have a really awesome way of looking at yoga, and I appreciate the book and also just kind of like how you represent the yoga community. I think it's really kind of a breath of fresh air, and I think it's humble and grounded, and I really appreciate that. So thanks.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Taylor. It'd be a joy to come back. I'd like to talk to you the next time a little bit about addiction as well, and some questions I have on that and on your experience. And I'm sure we can talk about other stuff. But, and as far as the yoga community goes and everything, I think it's a good idea for us all to be friends. So, let's be friends.
Of course. Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you again. And we'll speak again soon. We'll do episode 2 because that was totally worth it. So I appreciate it.
Awesome, man. Catch you later, Taylor. And anyone who's listening, thanks so much for listening.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in. If you want more information about Ashtanga Yoga, visit ashtangayogacolumbus.com. You can also check out my website, which is taylorhuntyoga.com. See you guys next time.